Today's program was brought to you by Le Creuset, made in France since 1925. The first and finest enameled cast iron cookware and a favorite for generations. For more information, visit lecreuset.com. That's LECREUSET.com. I'm HRN's Communications Director Kat Johnson with a preview of this week's episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup. Fall is finally here, so it's time to get funky and devote an episode to some of our favorite spunky microbes.
Fungi just provide this beautiful, whimsical lens on how the world works. They have so many roles. They're this strange and magical-seeming group of organisms, but they've got it all figured out.
Should you eat the cheese rind? Can you eat the rind? These are like the biggest questions.
We'll answer all of your questions about mysterious mushrooms and crazy curds. Plus, we'll give you a sneak listen to the newest season of Modernist Breadcrumbs. So tune in to this week's Meat and Three on Heritage Radio Network, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Why Food Podcast. I'm your co-host Ethan Frisch.
And I'm Jenny Dorsey.
And we have double guests for you this week.
Yay.
Awesome people who we have been trying to get on the podcast for a long time, and they're just too busy and too cool and traveling to too many places. The co-founders of Ovenly, Aaron Patinkin, who's the CEO, and Agatha Colago, who's the COO. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So let's just dive in with a little bit of background. What is Ovenly? What makes it so special? Both in Aaron's looking at us like this is a crazy question.
No, I just am getting feedback in my headphones. I'm like, what is going on right now?
Yeah, what is Ovenly and what makes it so special? Both sort of in the customer facing aspect of it, but also in the kitchen.
And you guys just celebrated an anniversary, so tell us about that too.
We did. So we've been in business now for over 8 years. It's about 8.5 years. And we are a wholesale and retail bakery based in New York. And we are the best bakery in the world, basically. our goal is to really be the neighborhood bakery in every neighborhood. And the ultimate thing that we're trying to do is bring joyful experiences to people everywhere. And we do that obviously through our baked goods and the experience that we're creating for people in our bake shops. And we have over 60 employees now, and we have 5 retail locations, and then we wholesale all over the city.
And tell us about some of your employment practices and what makes those different from other bakeries in the city.
Sure. So we don't just bake cookies. We are also a social impact company. So we make intentional decisions about our hiring practices and the types of jobs that we're trying to create for our team. And we try to offer great benefits and expand on those benefits. And we offer a lot of great perks at our company. But in terms of the jobs that we're trying to create, we're really looking to create quality jobs where we are making a difference in people's lives. And we hope that that will expand upon to the communities that we are actually serving. And so for us, we are focusing on the actual employee and not just making a profit for the company.
It's funny that feels so radical.
I was just going to say.
Radical responsibility.
So the basic idea is not that we're a nonprofit organization. We are a revenue-based organization that also has goals beyond revenue. And so I think that we need to kind of normalize this discussion, because what we do should not be out of the norm. It actually really, in my opinion, should be the norm. And Agatha and I have backgrounds in social justice work and social work, and that career really informed me. Agatha's career really informed her and the kind of company we wanted to create. So we're not a Tom's. We don't say we're giving shoes to, or we're not giving a cookie to a person every time we sell
that
a cookie.
Work.
What we are doing is we are creating a platform that we hope creates a more empathetic economy for everyone. So we're building good jobs. We're reducing our environmental impact. Last year, we were part of a grant that helped us reduce our landfill bound waste by 70%. We're working on a program right now that will make us, I think, the first carbon positive bakery in the country. And also within all of this, we're working to create benefits for our staff that they'll actually use so that we can bring people from maybe below poverty line to working class, to middle class and above. So it's really about career pathways, building wages and benefits for everyone. And that's really the heart of the impact that we're doing. And we're also trying to make it, not to be punny, but we're really trying to bake in the impact so that it is inseparable from the company. So it's not only, oh, this is what we do and we make revenues. We make revenues because this is what we do, and there is absolutely no way that you can separate the two. So in the case, in the future, if we ever decide to sell a business, it's part of our competitive advantage.
So I want to dive into the two of your backgrounds and just how much of that you were able, because you came from kind of non-traditional backgrounds into the food and food space, you're able to use a lot of that and kind of create something that a lot of food entrepreneurs, I think, have an idea to do, but don't know how to fully flesh it out and actually put it in practice.
Well, I think the political climate right now, there are a lot of companies that are thinking about things in a different way. And I think that there is a lot more discussions around social impact for for-profit businesses or within for-profit businesses. And one of the things, as Aaron mentioned, is that we both came from very different backgrounds, social justice, social work. And so a lot of our values, our personal values, were built into the business when we started the company. So it was not a conscious decision to really say, oh, we want to build and scale a business responsibly. It was something that we believed in from the moment that we started the business. And you know, we weaved it into the different practices that we had. There was a conscious decision to talk about it in a different way. And I think that that was something that we really sort of, we went back and forth on for a little bit, because we also didn't want to come across as disingenuous or inauthentic. I don't like to really use that word, but I think it was just important for us to send the message out in a way that was real and that was meaningful and that our customers understood, but not in a way where we were trying to sell a product because of the good things that we were doing. We wanted customers to be coming to us, and we wanted to be making the sales because people believed in what we were doing and that they were making a difference by actually being consumers for our business.
Did you consider other products, businesses besides pastry?
Well, I think that one of the things, just going off what Agatha said, I think, listen, we're entrepreneurs and we had no idea what we're doing for the first few years. So there wasn't really, even though we came from these backgrounds, there was literally no time to think about what impact meant to us at all. It wasn't even within our mind frame for the first 2 years, because all we were doing was baking and doing business 20 hours a day. I mean, it was bananas. So what basically happened was, it was really the moment that we could breathe, that we looked at each other and we're like, are we just making cookies? And honestly, that wasn't, it wasn't even a question. We were like, no, this can't be just it. I think that the trap with entrepreneurship is like, increase your revenues, increase your margins, sell as much as you can. And we've seen a lot of entrepreneurs start with some social impact missions, and then later in the game, you see them drop off because it is difficult to scale all of those things together. But, you know, my background is entirely in nonprofit work. I worked for mostly arts organizations and a feminist organization, getting back to your question. And I think that what my challenge was I went through college being like, I'm never going to work for a for-profit company. I'm not going to work for a corporation. I had a strong sense of kind of the social justice I wanted to bring into the world. And then, you know, fast forward 11 years and I felt so jaded, because I think that if any of the audience members have ever worked in a nonprofit, they're probably going to understand this, but, I've worked for probably 8, you know, I worked for the Chicago Children's Museum, I worked for the Museum of Contemporary Art, I worked for the National Council of Jewish Women, I worked for this art center, you know, and I worked for a theater company in Chicago, and all of them were community-based organizations. But what I saw happen was there was always barriers to innovation, because ultimately you're reporting back to a board of directors and to funders who are the people who are controlling your paychecks. And so I kept seeing this thing happen where organizations, not all of them, but a lot of them that I worked with would know that a program wasn't working after year one, but it was a 3-year grant. Mm-hmm. And the good grant makers let you pivot, but a lot of grant makers want to do this one thing. So you go back to them and say, hey, I want to pivot. And they say, no. Or, okay, well, then you can't have the rest of your grant. And then it developed. I kept seeing this like vicious cycle develop where people needed to keep the grant funding just to have that 30% fee for the administrative costs. And then 70% went to a program that wasn't working. I got really, really jaded. And so something that's been really fascinating to me about being an entrepreneur is that the flexibility that you have as an owner, like Agatha said, a company is ultimately reflective of its founders, right? And if the founders have particular values, it's probably going to be weaved into what the company's values are. And I've just found that I think we can create far more impact by being a for-profit company and being able to pivot as quickly as we can to market directions while also pivoting as quickly as we can to our staff's needs and being able to control all of our revenues completely because we're the ones selling. So I've just found it really fascinating that I find that we can actually do a lot more towards bringing a more socially just world into being than I could do while I was at nonprofit organizations.
Where did this idea come from? What's the origin story? How did you two meet and where did all of this come together?
We met in a food focused book club and Aaron and I started talking. We both had a vision of building a business. And when we met, we started really chatting about what that would look like. And it was only a week later after we had met at this book club dinner. And then it just went from there. We really just went for it. We were still at our full-time jobs. And we just started talking about different business ideas. We were both passionate about food and business. And it organically came to be. We did not have a vision of owning a bakery. And that that also, I think, just happened. We were in the right place at the right time in terms of where the industry was in coffee and pastries. We started off as a bar snack business, and it evolved into a bakery. 8.5 years later, that is what we're doing.
What was the bar snack business?
Well, it was always ovenly.
It was always ovenly.
Basically, what happened was we didn't know what we wanted to do. So we'd go drink at bars.
Yeah.
And we're like, oh, no one has good bar snacks. Yeah. And in New York, a lot of bars just have booze. And so we decided to start this company, thought it was going to be great. And then one of Agatha's friends was like, well, I'll sell your bar snacks, but I need pastries in the morning. And this was before mixed retail was really a thing. Like, actually, looking back, she was really ahead of the game, but no one got it. So she had a place that was a bar at night and a cafe in the morning. And so she sold our bar snacks, but we just decided to make baked goods for her, and then like we had to quit our jobs.
And she also
so quickly because no one wanted the bar snacks. Yeah. Everyone
well, where the bar snacks? People are chasing us down for these pastries.
They were
not the bar
so
snacks.
Good though. Yeah. We had spicy bacon caramel corn, which was amazing, and then we had like a honey almond corn. I mean, we kept testing all these
old
other
salties.
Things. We had old bacon fat roasted Old Bay peanuts.
Oh, that sounds good.
Which I mean, it's like chefs. It was like very chefy innovation. We were making all this spicy bacon caramel corn, and we'd have so much bacon fat left over. We're like, what do we do with this?
Although.
And
we
made peanuts roasted in the bacon fat.
The weird thing was, though, is that at that point we had our first bake shop and we were making these bacon fat roasted peanuts.
Oh, yeah.
And we had a bakery and people were coming in and being like, why does it smell like meat in here?
had either of you worked in food before? How did you learn to bake all of the beautiful things that you bake?
I mean, we were servers.
We worked in restaurants.
Yeah, we worked in restaurants. But I mean, just as a passion, we love to bake. I mean, that was definitely part of our lives, but we did not. I mean, truly.
We had no idea what we were doing.
We knew how to bake for our friends. We knew how to make 12 cookies. We didn't know how to scale to a batch of 5,000. I mean, so, you know, at different points in time, we've had to get people in to help us figure some of that out. But, yeah, we didn't have a business plan, didn't know what we were doing, and it was very backwards.
Up until a few years ago, people that were working with us would say, why are you guys doing it this way? And we were like, that's what we figured out when we first started. Feel free to change it. It was really, I mean, we've obviously made a lot of changes, but it was a process. It was a learning curve for us.
One of the big things about Emily is the sweet and salty component. Is that because of the bar snacks, the salty came in?
I think that's just because we like it.
Yeah.
It was really it. It's like, we were like, ooh, we were just making stuff that we liked. I mean, that was it.
And also, if you look at the pastry and baked good industry, a lot of things are overly sweet, right? Mm-hmm. And And I think that that's where people really fail. And we were trying to hit this perfect intersection of, you know, sweet, little savory, where nothing is overwhelming. And our the whole purpose of what we're doing is that we want our baked goods to be people's daily indulgence. So we want people to be coming in every single day. So in order to be able to treat yourself, something has to be palatable and not overly sweet and something that you want to eat every day.
And not feel bad after.
And not feel bad afterwards, exactly.
Yeah. So for the
We're sad. We're sad for the time we have to hit 15 stores and put our own calorie counts on things. It's so nice to live in that ignorance for now.
So for the first bakery order, what did you guys make?
Oh.
Oh, God.
I don't know. I mean, we've basically the
Baker's Choice.
Our menu was Baker's Choice. I can't believe people hired us.
I know. It was really sad.
Like, it was just like whatever we wanted to do.
It was like cookie, muffin,
scone,
quick bread, scone, Baker's Choice. And we basically, whatever we made in the kitchen that night is what people would get. And people could just decide on the
numbers.
Quantities.
Yeah. It was crazy.
Not the flavors.
But
so
we,
that was our
from
menu.
The beginning, we had the peanut butter cookie, the chocolate chip cookie, and the currant rosemary scone.
Yeah. Those were my
favorite. And the pistachio cardamom bread. All four.
Oh,
geez.
Those are classics.
Were from the beginning.
Yeah.
And Agatha, what was your... We heard a little bit about Aaron's career prior to Evan Lee. What were you doing?
So I spent time working in restaurants since I was 15. My first... one of my first jobs was at TGI Fridays, where I worked for 4 years. And I worked in the front of house. And then I just continued to... I supported myself through school by working in restaurants while I was studying. And then I came to New York and I worked... I also worked for a few nonprofits during that time, and I got a job at a nonprofit when I first came to New York, and that lasted 3 months. It was one of the craziest jobs I've ever had. A lot of the same issues that Aaron was speaking to in terms of bureaucracy and really, you know, hitting walls in any change that I tried to make. And then I got a job at NYU School of Medicine, where I ended up building my career there. I was there for 9.5 years, and I worked in mental health and addictions research. So I was on the academic side, where we were doing research on sort of innovation in mental health and addictions treatment, but then also working on the community treatment program side. So I got to see how a lot of nonprofits actually worked in New York City across treatment programs there. And so it was a really interesting experience for me, because I really saw things on two very different levels. And I loved working with people. It was the thing that I really enjoyed, and I felt like that's where I could make the most impact. But I also got burnt out on that job, and I was there for quite some time. And it was exhausting. And so what I did was I baked on the side to sort of, you know, relieve a lot of the stress. I would bring in baked goods for the clients and patients that I would see. And that was where I realized that I was creating joy on a different level for the people that I was seeing, where, you know, there was a serious side of, you know, treatment. And then I would bring in these cookies or whatever I baked that day, and people would freak out. And, you know, they would come back to see me just to eat these baked goods. And that's really how that evolved. But I was baking on the side for a long time. But I also found myself going back. I worked at my friend's restaurant while I had this full-time job. I would leave work at 5:30, go work until midnight, 1 a.m., and then do the same thing the next day. And so I was just always drawn back to the food industry.
When the two of you first started working together, since it was a relatively short courtship, I mean, what were
there
you?
There was no courtship.
There was no courtship. We were like, let's be business partners.
Which is
do it.
Very dangerous, but it worked out.
How did you know that it was the right fit?
I looked into Agatha's eyes.
Yeah.
And I said, she's the one. No, I don't know. I think that, like, we, you know, I think Agatha and I, I think there were two things that made it work. One, we both were in careers. We wanted to leave. And we wanted to start our own business. So we had that as the unifying factor. And two, just we're workhorses. Yeah. I think a lot of people have issues in their partnerships because one person isn't shouldering as much as the work as the other person, or the other person's not as ambitious as the other person, or the other person isn't willing to compromise. We had all of those things within us. We were willing to compromise. We were equally ambitious, and we would work ourselves to death to get this company off the ground. And so, you know, I think that, you know, we definitely have had our moments, and especially in the first couple of years, which we were truly sleep deprived. Yeah. Like, looking back on that time, I think if I had committed a crime, I could have pled insanity. Yeah. We were like averaging like 3 hours of night asleep for a long time.
Yeah.
But I think that, you know, definitely in those moments, I feel like that period of time was way more emotional than it is now, because we were just so stressed. And, you know, when you start a company, you have no money. We didn't take a salary at all. We were barely eating. We were like eating cookies all day because we were chocolate. So broke. And so that's all we could afford to do. I mean, so I think that the first 2 years were harder, but then it just kind of, the only person I know who wants to make
2 years.
Well, I think it's true though, that like, we know the only people who want this company to succeed as much as, like, the only person I know who wants this company to succeed as much as I do is my business partner, is Agatha. So I think that that's really important.
But I think we also, we both had a get shit done attitude from the moment that we met. And but I do think that we also balance each other out in really great and positive ways. And I think that that's been helpful. We sort of gravitated towards our own roles over time. And I think that in doing that, we, you know, we both have strengths and we both have areas of opportunity or areas that, you know, one of us does better than the other. And I think it also is just, that evolves, and acknowledging that is really important. And as Aaron said, you know, there are a lot of hard times, but I think ultimately for us, we were both very capable of setting our emotions aside, and it's for the business, right? And I think that that's when it's a little bit different. If you're best friends, things get really emotional, and yes, there's emotions involved, and I think it's important to acknowledge those, but ultimately at the end of the day, we're able to set those aside and really focus on, you know, our immediate and long-term goals.
How have you decided to divide responsibilities, both at the beginning of the partnership and now 8 years in? How has that evolved?
I mean, at the beginning, we didn't divide anything. And I think that there was some tension around that because we were both trying to do everything, which is so dumb. Like, we should have
delegated.
I think from the beginning, we should have been like, what are you going to do? What am I going to do? But, you know, whatever you live, you learn. There was an actual day where we were standing in our kitchen. We had just opened our Greenpoint kitchen and bake shop. And it just became clear that someone had to, at the time, it was really back of house, front of house. That's really, now it's, we're too big to have that be the division, but it was kind of, it was almost like a coin toss, but Agatha's much more systems and operations minded anyway. So she took over, and very good at sales. So she kind of took over all the sales and wholesale operations, which is now wholesale sales, big corporate sales, and general like
business development stuff
and like manufacturing operations, which is very different today than it was 8 years ago. And then now I kind of took on the rest of that, but now that side has kind of grown, so we're trying to hire another C-level person. But I've been like finance, marketing, and retail. But you know, we have managers underneath us that do an amazing job. Karen Damasco is our executive pastry chef and kitchen director. I mean, she's amazing. She's had 20-30 years incredible. Experience.
Yeah.
Our retail director, Jody Rodriguez, I mean, she was managing and retail directing at Urban Outfitters for like 17 years before she came to us. So we have really high level people who are helping us. And just, and besides all of those people, we have like such a fantastic team. And without them, we wouldn't be able to do what we do every day.
But to speak to the dividing up of responsibilities, I think it really is, you know, in the beginning, there's so much ownership, or at, you know, as founders of the company, we take so much ownership in what we do and what we build. And I think sometimes it's really hard to let go of certain things. Mm-hmm. And the delegation piece is so huge. And it took us a while to do that because we wanted to do everything and we wanted to be involved in everything in the decision-making process. And I think, you know, you need to let that go.
Also,
and
it's like flipped so much now. We're like, please don't make please, us do it.
Exactly. Like, you please. Decide. You decide.
You we do really, it.
Yeah.
I guess it's like,
it's really,
I've realized I've gone from like trying to hold on to everything so tightly to being like, I really want someone to do more for me.
Yeah.
And you get decision fatigue at some point. Yeah. It's like, just do this.
Just
thing,
do it.
You know?
Just make the decision yourself and
wrong,
come back to us
if it's
and
wrong,
let us
we'll
know.
Fix it.
Yeah, yeah. We'll figure it out if it doesn't go well. But it really, that is so important.
I think that's something a lot of small business owners, especially entrepreneurs, really struggle with.
Yeah.
Not just the decision or the ability within yourself to give those to empower your team to make those decisions, but also your employees. How do they feel supported enough to make, you know, open themselves up to potentially mm-hmm. making mistakes. How have you done that? How have you created that kind of culture?
Yeah, I think that going back to the delegation piece, when we were trying to be involved in everything and own everything, I think that there was probably, I know there was more tension related to that, because then you are not empowering someone to make those decisions and you know, really put their best foot forward and try to make the decisions based on all of the training and support that they're receiving. And, you know, it minimizes their capacity and their ability to work. And so I think one of the things that we really changed a few years ago was how we interviewed people when we were hiring them. And we started to really ask value aligned questions when during the interview process, which, you know, we interview people many, many times before we hire anyone for, you know, higher level positions. And it really was about making sure that the potential employee is the right fit for the company culture. And there's been a lot of times where we've made mistakes, and I think it's also acknowledging that and learning from that. But we've also learned that if someone is the wrong fit, it's so, so important to acknowledge that and address that as soon as possible and just let someone go. And I, you know, that took us a while to do, but ultimately it ends up being a bigger cost to the company and having such a detrimental impact on company culture and morale when you don't make those decisions earlier. And they're hard decisions to make.
We really are slow to hire, quick to fire.
Yep.
Yep.
Because, you know, it's in firing someone, it's 99.5% of the times when we let someone go, it's just because they're not the right match for the company. And that goes on all sides. You know, you have a person who's chronically late. Are they a bad person? No, but we have expectations here on time. You have a person who, you know, may manage in a way that is kind of contradictory to your values. Are they a bad person? No, but it's not the right fit. And we just, there, you know, there's only so much training you can do and so many conversations you can have before you just realize that someone's the wrong fit. And I think it's detrimental for the company and for the person to keep someone on who's the wrong fit.
Can you give us an example of a question that you guys have started asking that's a little bit more aligned with your values to make sure you can kind of flesh that out with new hires, potential new hires?
This kind of started, this new line of questioning started once because I visited with this guy, Richard Corain, who is, I don't know his exact title right now, but it used to be director of operations at Union Square Hospitality Group. I think he's now like director of people.
Yeah.
And I went into his office once and I was like talking to him about staffing issues, and I was asking him how he dealt with, you know, keeping people vision and value aligned and all the stuff. And he gets up and he was like, oh, I have something for you. And he walks away and he comes back and it's a business card, and on it it says, good luck with that. And I love that so much. But he was like, we start from higher, and he basically gave me a list of questions, and then we evolved it into something that made sense for us. But one of the questions we ask is, what's the last gift you gave to anyone for any reason? Because that shows kind of selflessness, right? Mm-hmm. Who do you admire for any reason? That shows that people are thinking about other people. You know, I think the gift thing has been a really interesting question, because when someone comes in and starts talking about this, actually our retail director, Jody Rodriguez, she was like, started talking about her best friend and mm-hmm. how she knits, and her best friend was like knitting a scarf, and she's so inspiring to Jody. And she started to cry and started like to tell us about the gift she gave her. And we were like, oh yeah, you love people. You know, it's a sign. And we had another person interview once, and we said, what's the last gift you gave to anyone for any reason? And he was like, I don't remember. And then he was like, I think I gave my kid an iPad or something.
Oh,
and
God.
We were like, oh yeah, this is it's really telling when people, how people answer these like emotional IQ questions.
Mm-hmm.
And what skills do you find that that brings, or how does that translate into the workplace?
I think that generally we are looking for people. Also we're in the food industry still. And unfortunately still, a lot of people who end up in management and director positions have grown up in kitchens and restaurants where abusive behavior is the norm.
Yeah.
And so a lot of the people who apply with us have grown up in the food world. And unfortunately, as we're learning every day with, you know, the Me Too movement, oftentimes, restaurants and food companies have toxic cultures.
Yep.
And so it helps us weed people out pretty quickly, because if you can tell that someone loves another person and feels selfless about themselves in regard to someone else, it's a pretty good indicator that there'll be vision and value aligned, right? And so I think, and like, we want to be empathetic leaders, firm but fair. Yeah. So I think that that's kind of how it's reflective.
And it also, we do ask, you know, what are you looking for in company culture? And I think that that is something, if someone responds to that in a way that's, you know, I'm looking to move up, I'm looking to build a career and make money, and that's it. That
like,
will.
Why are you in the food world?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Bye. But I do think that it's really important to sort of gauge that up front, because if you're not value aligned, it's not going to work. But you know, to speak to that too, I think we're really fortunate because our managers and the leadership in our company right now, people have empathy, and it's so important because, especially in the food world, as Aaron mentioned, there's very abusive, toxic environments, and we are not trying to create a culture where that is the case. And I think it is challenging to promote that in some ways, because in a kitchen, there is a get shit done attitude, right? You need to, there's hustle and you need to move and things need to move quickly. Yeah. But at the same time, our managers are also people that really care about our staff. And it's not a culture where they're screaming at people. And it takes time to be able to address people's challenges in the workplace, especially in a kitchen. And I feel so grateful for our managers in the kitchen, because they are doing the extra work and going the extra mile to really do all of that. So on top of just being a kitchen manager and directing people and managing production and operations in there, they are really creating a culture for our staff where if a team member is experiencing challenges getting to work or with childcare or something, they are making the decisions to say, okay, is there anything we could do to help? Okay, we will work around your schedule. You're not going to get fired. And I think that that has really improved retention, but it does, you know, it's not easy. And so it's especially important to hire people that have empathy and are able to be intuitive to people's needs. And you know, we are really lucky to have a great team that does that well.
Well, with that, I think that's a really high note to go on our mid podcast break, and we'll be back in about 90 seconds.
Today's program was brought to you by Le Creuset, the first to pioneer colorful enameled cookware over 90 years ago. They've been a favorite for generations through the meals and memories the cookware creates and the style it expresses. My name is Kat Johnson. I'm the communications director at Heritage Radio Network. When I'm not making food radio, I'm making food, and my favorite cookware is the 8-quart marine blue Dutch oven that never leaves my stovetop. Before we got our Le Creuset, the cookware we used most often was an antique Griswold cast iron pan. It didn't take long for me to realize how much I'd been missing enamel cast iron in my life. Le Creuset has the superior heat retention of cast iron, but paired with the unparalleled performance and ease of enamel. That means delicious food with easy cleanup. Head to lecreuset.com/HRN, that's LECREUSET.com/HRN, to see all the new products and amazing holiday gift deals. HRN listeners will get 20% off the new Le Creuset cookbook with the code HRN.
Welcome back. This is Why Food Podcast, and we're here today with the co-founders of Ovenly, Aaron Patinkin and Agatha Kulaga, the CEO and the COO, respectively. So we've been talking a lot about social impact and how to marry that with your business. So I want to also drive the conversation over to funding. We were talking about this a little bit before we got on the show, but how do you marry those two things so not only people, investors, understand that you have, you know, two bottom lines, so to speak.
Three.
Three bottom lines. But also make sure that you have the right investors who are actually going to help you with that as you scale and grow.
Wait, what's the third bottom line?
Environment.
Oh, yeah, yeah, of course.
Jobs and revenues.
Jobs.
So I think that's a really good question. So Agatha mentioned at the beginning of the podcast that there is more familiarity now today with what social impact is than there was when we started, for sure. I'll tell you, it's not. There's definitely been a growth in the acceptance of this idea that, you know what, we could be getting 7% EBITDA every year across all the categories, but we're going for 5.8 because that 1.2% is going to go back to building a good company. People have definitely started to accept that. I mean, you saw there's a huge company called BlackRock Group. They manage $4 trillion of investments and property and other assets. And the CEO recently, after years of work, came out with a statement that anyone in their portfolio had to have some sort of social impact mission in their company because that's what young people want to see and it's important for the world, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. So when you see that kind of person with so much power coming out and saying, if you want to participate in my company, then you have to do X, Y, and Z. I think that that shows that there's a big cultural shift happening. Obviously, that's not without pushback from certain people. But, you know, I think when we first started, Agatha already mentioned, we were really hesitant to talk about social impact. We really didn't know how. We didn't want to seem like a Tom's. And yeah, we've slowly changed the messaging, and we've really been strong now in the messaging. So it might not be all over the stores, but you can easily find out about it online. And I think there was a big shift for the two of us because in 2015, we started our first real outside raise of capital. So we had some angel investors and we decided to raise money from individuals. We weren't going for institutional investors at the time. And we were doing this pitch festival and someone advised us not to talk about the social impact in our pitch. And it was like the second slide in our pitch. And Agatha and I said, no, we're going to talk about it because it's such an important part of the business. And also, if we don't speak about it and then do this and can't explain why we provide better benefits, which cost more money than other companies of our size, then it's like we've hoodwinked investors in a way. And so we included it anyway, and we won the pitch festival. And one of the things that a big piece of feedback from every investor in that room was, you are the only company here that is doing impact in a way that's really ingrained in the business. And it's not just revenues back, you know, you're not giving 2% of revenues. You're actually trying to build a better local economy. And we believe in that. And so it was really eye-opening to us because we kind of were instructed not to talk to investors about that. And we decided to do it anyway. And we were like, yeah, we internally knew that it was a competitive advantage in a lot of ways. And it turned out to be true. Because the other thing is, if you want to look at it just from the aspect of pure capitalism, if you're just looking at it from a money perspective, on the job side, we have job partners. We're in a city with a massive labor shortage. Mm-hmm. When we have a job opening, we go to one of our job partners and say, is there someone in your group that could be trained to be in our kitchen or in one of our stores? And the answer is always yes. So we don't have to put up a Craigslist ad every time. We have someone who's already been vetted by people we trust. So it's huge. And I think on the other side, on the environmental side, we've just saved a bunch of money. You know, the more efficient we are and the more energy efficient we are, the more money we save. And so if you just want to communicate it in dollars, which I think is wrong, it's a competitive advantage that way. But it's also an advantage because consumers do care. And it's not about, and I do think we are moving into a culture where we are buying with our dollars in a thoughtful way. And I think a lot of people, I think right now people are coming to us because we have the best cookies in the world, hands down. But also they're starting to understand that we have value beyond just the, you know, Brooklyn blackout cakes we make and they care.
Yeah, I think that's where a lot of social enterprises get tripped up is either there isn't an inherently causal relationship between the social impact and the product or the brand, and they rest on social impact laurels, and maybe the quality of whatever they're making or doing suffers.
Yeah.
How have you found ways to communicate that intrinsic connection to your customers who are walking in for a coffee or a slice of pistachio cardamom cake? Is that what it is?
Yeah.
And don't really know and may not be sort of naturally inclined to care about the social impact side of the business.
One of the first things that we did when we were testing the boundaries with that was we surveyed all of our wholesale customers and our retail customers and asked very direct questions about whether they knew about the values that we had as a company. And so by doing that, we were indirectly informing them of what we were doing without actually, you know, putting banners up. And that was the first step to it. And, you know, we asked our customers questions. Do you care about this? Do you care about the fact that we use all natural ingredients? Do you care that we are creating quality jobs for our staff and are paying living wages? And across the board, everyone said yes. And
we actually said, would you pay more for our products now that you know?
Yes. And they said
100%
yes.
Of a few hundred people said yes. Yeah. That was really eye-opening. We're like, oh, okay, we got to talk about this more because that's good to know.
It was huge. And, you know, and many people said, we would spend more money with you. We would be coming here more if we had known this sooner. And so that was really eye-opening for us. So that was really the first step. And now there's various ways that we do it.
I think it's the company to consumer message is harder. Mm-hmm. I think the internal message is easier because, again, it's a real tricky balance between talking about it enough and talking about it too much because it's still about selling cookies and delicious stuff.
Good product.
Yeah. And so I think that's actually one of our biggest challenges. Whereas internally, we talk about it all the time and people totally are on board. They understand what we're doing. I do think it's a challenge. Right now, it's mostly we train our retail staff and we train them to talk about impact and also posting on social media.
Yeah.
But it's not super ever present in the stores. It's something that we're working on and thinking about all the time is how to better craft that message so people know more about what we do.
Can we talk a little bit about the benefits that you had mentioned earlier? Just holistic benefits, why they cost more, and where you hope the standard of benefits will go in the food industry as that now that you're kind of paving the way for it.
Huge news. Benefits oftentimes don't cost more.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's not really a cost more. It's just adding like the more benefits you add, there is an added cost. It's not that benefits cost more.
Exactly. You know what I mean? Exactly. And I think that is what we have been focusing on for a very long time now, because there are creative ways to offer great benefits to staff without actually spending that much money. And I will toot our own horn and say that we probably offer more progressive benefits than a lot of the giant corporate companies that exist right now. Mm-hmm. And we feel really proud of that. But, you know, for example, one of our benefits is free yoga to staff. And that is through a personal relationship that we had with someone that owns a yoga studio. And we said, would you be willing to do a trade? If we had our staff come in for yoga, we'll give you free treats for your staff and for catering. And he said yes. And, you know, that was really something that just happened organically. And you know, the other thing, too, that just in speaking about the free yoga, it's great. And we have a big team. I would say maybe around 8 to 10 people use it. And one of the things that we also think about is, you know, what are the benefits that more people will use? And that is something that we're always considering. You know, it gets tricky because the more benefits you offer, the more I think people get it gets lost, right? Yep. People, we offer a lot of benefits and we want people to actually utilize them. And so we have been really thinking creatively and strategically about what makes the most sense and streamlining things where we're not offering 7,000 benefits that no one is using. We're really trying to be intentional about the benefits that we do offer. So we offer health insurance and we offer paid sick time, paid vacation time.
For everyone, though.
For everyone.
Not just full-time staff.
We offer
health insurance full-time, but vacation and sick time and all everything else is for the entire staff, part-time or full-time.
Yeah, and it also, our vacation time, we offer in a way where the longer you stay with us, the more that you can accrue, mm-hmm. so that there's, you know, a benefit to people that work with us for a longer time, but it also improves retention rates as well.
Maternity leave.
We have a very...
Well, it's primary and secondary caregiver leave. And basically what happened was we had a staff member quite some time ago who became pregnant. And, you know, most of our staff are under 30, under 35.
Yeah.
And we said, okay, what should this look like? And we got... I have a friend at Etsy. She sent me her package. I have a friend at Wall Street Journal. She sent me her package. And we just were like, okay, we're going to make this more liberal than that. And so you get up to 6 months, and then you have an option for like another 6 weeks to come back part time. Secondary caregivers get 2 months. And the reason we did this is we did some cost benefit analysis. You know, again, we're still a business. We have to look into this stuff. And we realized that it was far more important to us for there to be consistency amongst our staff. And then from a political perspective, we just believe that people should have time to bond with their children.
Yes.
And so that's basically the two angles we took. Can we afford it? Yep. Okay. And this is what we believe in. Because ultimately, we want people to have families, and we want people to be able to be parents.
And be happy.
And be happy.
And be happy, exactly.
And also, I have to say, unlike a lot of other food businesses, and this is not a benefit, this is just standard of living, we have a 40-hour work week. If you work overtime, you get paid overtime. We don't do any of this BS cash fake payments. We don't do shift pay, and we don't garnish people's wages for tips. We have straight up minimum wage across the board, including front of house staff who get tipped. And our back of house staff start at higher levels. So it's really, we don't believe in this sort of like robbing of our staff. And of course, that's not benefit, but that unfortunately, that is very typical of food world.
Why do you think that's so common? And why do you
think? Because people are bad business people.
Yeah.
People don't know how to run businesses.
People are trying to make money and don't know how to run a business well and don't care about staff.
They're either greedy and they just want to make the most money for themselves. They are advantageous and they know people come to New York to cook, and they know that they can take advantage of those people.
The number or three, of times
they just don't know how to manage a P&L, and they don't know how to cost out their product, and they cut corners by paying people in cash or paying people shift pay. I think it's truly one of the most messed up parts about the food industry.
The number of times that people have said to us, you know, at some point as you grow, you need to start cutting corners somewhere. We don't cut corners. We will not do something if it does not make sense for a company and it's not the right thing to do. I would rather stay this size than cut corners in any way. And that is a comment that is made very often. You know, what's incredible too is that the two women that have gone on maternity leave are still with us, and it's been several years now, and that also feels good. You know, we know their families, and they're, you know, a part of our team.
We have our first secondary caregiver going on
paternity leave in January.
So I mean, it's awesome.
Yeah,
I'm like, great.
It feels great. We're really excited. Yeah. Exactly.
Have you had pushback from investors, or how have investors?
Honestly, the good investors, they're always like, I have given 100% pay into healthcare, and I've given paternity and maternity leave from day one, and you guys need to figure it out too.
We're getting there.
We had this experience when we raised money a few years ago where this investor was like, the first thing I would do is cut everyone's wages and like, let's move you to New Jersey. And we're like, you know what? Thanks, but no thanks. See you later. It's like at some point you just have to, if you're in the lucky enough position that you don't have to take money from anyone, don't take money from anyone. Take money from people who are vision and value aligned who would never say that to you.
I was about to say that's the one thing that we learned too, is that, you know, when you're first starting a business, you're scrambling, and you know, we needed the money, and we took the money where it came from and where it was available, and you know, it got us to where we are now. So we're very grateful for that. But at the same time, now when we meet with potential investors, we talk about our values, and
we
start with our values, and we ask them about their values. Right. And it's a very transparent conversation, because at this point, as Aaron said, we want people along for the ride that care about what we're doing and care about, you know, the entire company as a whole.
We just took on our first debt financing from an organization called the Good Jobs Fund. Mm-hmm. And the first conversation we had with them, we sent them our vision and values. And we said, can you please send us your vision and values? Mm-hmm. And they created an entire new workbook for us about what they were trying to do internally as a company and externally with the companies they were investing in. That's how our conversations go now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because I think the other thing to remember, I mean, part of this whole financing talk is, as the entrepreneur, always remember that your idea has value. And I think that raising money is a lot of times about power. There's always some power play that's involved, no matter who it is. But don't ever forget that you have value. And if you don't believe in what an investor is telling you, you should say that, because either that investor will change his or her tune and you've educated them around something, or that's the wrong investor.
Yeah. Yep.
And that's not the right person to bring in. An investor is a partner. An investor is not, unless you're one of these very lucky people who has investors that don't care about what you're doing. Most investors I know, even the ones who have like a small amount of money in the company, want to know what we're up to and want to hear about what we're doing. So you have to look at investors as partners, not just as people giving you money. And who would you want as a partner?
And you have to think about it as a long-term relationship, because it's not a one-year relationship. It's a long relationship that is probably going to get worse down the road if you if you're not talking about those things up front.
Yeah. I mean, especially in the recent pilot work shutdown and all of that, where people are like, what went wrong? So much money went in here, and then what happened?
It's incredibly, incredibly sad and disappointing. And over 150 producers were left without space. And
that's like hundreds of jobs.
This hundreds of jobs. And also, this is, you know, businesses are going to go out of business if they haven't already because of it. And it's just, it's irresponsible. And we don't have to talk about that.
Well, and I mean, what I found so frustrating about the coverage of it has been...
Should we tell the audience what the pilot work situation was?
Oh, yeah.
Everybody,
super quick recap. Yeah. For anyone who doesn't know, Pilot Works was a shared commercial kitchen in which 175 about business operated in. And essentially, a VC firm ran it. And 3 days... basically, they ran out of money and told everyone they had 3 days to leave. And in New York, commercial space is very hard to find.
And no storage.
Yeah. And no storage. And they also had, they were running a distribution company. So that distribution company was also, it got shut down. So people, not only did they not have a place to produce, but then they also had no one to distribute their products. And they had orders, huge orders for giant companies that they could not fulfill.
Holiday season,
and
too.
It's been blamed.
It's the busiest season.
Yeah, but it's been, I think what I found frustrating is that it's been blamed on, you know, the business model of a commercial kitchen or, but actually it was an approach, an investment approach that said, we're going to either grow this really big
rapid
or we're going to run it into the ground. And there's no middle ground. And they opened in several other cities and couldn't sustain the growth.
A lot of startups have this attitude. Yeah. I'm just going to raise as much money as possible and spend it as quickly as possible instead of looking sustainable growth. And also, you know, I have a mentor named Will Rosenzweig, and he's amazing. And real food investors understand that food is a long-term play.
Mm-hmm.
It historically, if you look at food companies, those companies were really built for what's called cash flows. You were earning money on your net revenues at the end of the day. Now with Silicon Valley, the attitude is like, oh, well, build it and then sell it. You know what? We hear about these big, fantastic exits. That is a fraction of 1% of companies get to that point where they can sell it for $100 million. But there's a shift in attitude with some inexperienced investors. I don't care if these people have invested in Twitter. Like, Twitter is not, you know, an ice cream company. And this mentor of mine who's built many food businesses says that he likes to remind other investors who are interested in food but new to food that it takes a year to grow a carrot. Think about that. Like, you have to actually plan for everything that has to do with the cycles of growth and farming and everything else, and then build a company off of that. And, you know, even with us, we've seen, we have to plan for fluctuations in ingredients prices in the future. You know, it's like, how do we buffer cost now just in case dairy increases by 50%, which we, or vanilla by 200%, which we've seen. So it's, I think that that's one of the problems with VCs who are coming in and convincing people that they're the ones to run the company because they know money. Well, I don't care. Yeah. You got to know food if you're going to be in food.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I wish we could keep talking longer, but unfortunately our hour is up. It's been such a pleasure having you both on the podcast.
Thanks for having us.
Before we wrap up, tell our listeners where they can find you and your baked goods. And then I think there's some other cool projects that you're working on. Yeah.
Our baked goods can be found in 150 different coffee shops, grocery stores, and cafes all over the city, all over the boroughs. And then Agatha and I both have a bunch of new projects that we're working on right now.
We have five
stores.
Did you forget about our stores?
And we have five
those exist stores, as well.
Five Ovenly Bake Shops. We have two in Greenpoint. One is a kind of test kitchen experimental space, one in Williamsburg, Park Slope, and Midtown. Mm-hmm. So, and we have two more opening up next year. Yeah. Paper is not signed, but we'll have some news soon about where those will be.
Very exciting, very news. Exciting coming news. Soon.
And then Agatha and I are both working on a lot of projects because one of our values is to teach it and share it, because that's the biggest way that we can get our word out about what we're doing is to come on shows like this and talk. I have a podcast now on Vox Media and Eater called Start to Sail with Natasha Case of Cool House Ice Cream Sandwiches, where we're exploring very specific business concepts in detail with a bunch of amazing business leaders, from Jay Werwin to Dermalogica to Christina Tosi from Milk Bar.
And there was an episode on today.
There's episode on today with Jane Werwin for Dermalogica, and it's amazing. And it actually dives into a lot of what we were talking about today. Her whole thing is empathetic leadership. And every episode ends with how a skill, and her skill was how to fire someone.
There you go. Cool.
And you want to plug what you wrote recently, too?
I also wrote an article in Vice. Vice relaunched their magazine. It's quarterly now. And the first one was, I think, about the future of work. It was the actual theme. And I wrote all about my experience with, Agatha, my experience raising money back in 2015 and 2016. And then Agatha has some pretty awesome stuff that she's doing with on a planning committee for women in food.
Yeah, so there is an incredible organization called Women in Hospitality United that is really working on shifting power dynamics in the food industry and changing policy, impacting policy, and offering a lot of resources for women in the food industry for empowerment. And there's a lot coming up with that. And then also working on some things around mental health in the food industry. And we also brought you guys, just to plug that, we have our holiday pies now available for order. And we brought a chocolate pecan cookie pie. Mm. And it's in front of you, and you guys should have
some
right now.
As soon as we turn the mics off, we're diving in.
So, all right, cool.
Big things, Women in Hospitality United.
Which was started by Aaron Fairbanks, Elizabeth Meltz, and they are two really incredible women. Oh, and sorry, and Liz as well from the Marlowe Collective, and they're doing a lot, but they have a ton of experience in the food industry. And Aaron Fairbanks, obviously, also
works used to be HR.
Exactly. It all ties together in some way. It's a small world.
Yeah. So, Women in Hospitality United, pies from Ovenly, www.oven.ly. Start to sale.co. And
social media, Instagram, Twitter.
Oh, yeah. Ovenly.
At Ovenly.
At Ovenly NYC on Facebook, at Ovenly on Twitter and Instagram. So come visit us in all the places, including in our stores.
Amazing.
Nice, thanks. I'm going to read a quick little plug for Heritage Radio Network's holiday party, which is coming up on December 3rd. Yeah. So,
Do you need cookies?
We might need cookies. Any listeners who are feeling, you know, getting ready for their big holiday season parties and want to kick it off on December 3rd with Heritage Radio, check out heritageradionetwork.org/gala for more information. It's going to be awesome.
And as usual, you can find us at Why Food Podcast on Facebook and Instagram. And if you have nominations, questions, thoughts, please email us. We are whyfood@heritageradionetwork.org.
And you can find me via my spice company at Burlap and Barrel on Instagram or burlapandbarrel.com.
And I'm at Chef Jenny Dorsey. And thank you to Crickets, Blind by the
our
Red.
Our theme song, which no matter how many times we listen to it, we can never remember what they're called. No, Blind by the Red Crickets for being our awesome theme music provider.
Wait, not I Will Always Love You by Whitney.
That was Roberta's dining room theme song today. If you hear it in the background, that's what it was. Thanks for joining us. And tune in next week for an awesome interview with Ben Jacobson of Jacobson Salt.
Thanks. Oh, nice. Woo-hoo. Thanks, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.